It was a storage place right near us. That's what we picked, and it was extremely well tucked away at the same time as being able to get trucks in and out quite easily.
Right, just hop on the freeway, and it's super hidden.
Yeah. And that specific one was really sort of stashed.
Okay, so I have decided to go to the public storage container where my dad used to stash, you know, thousands of pounds of pot. So I wanted to come here on my way to the city and see what it felt like. When I was growing up, my dad's storage unit was one of my favorite places because a visit there was both a rare occurrence and it was a fantastic playland of furniture for fort building and romping. It was also across the freeway from my favorite restaurant, McDonald's, which I only got to go to on my birthday, or maybe if I was super lucky and my dad totally worn down by my whining after a rare trip to the storage unit. But this storage unit wasn't where my dad would store his vintage and water-damaged furniture. The furniture was just there to hide thousands of pounds of pot that moved in and out of Mill Valley via my dad's prolific smuggling business. I got to the storage unit and I called my partner to talk to because I needed someone besides myself to work this out with. All right, the phone is on. This is happening. There you are. Hi.
Hey.
So I just parked at the public storage shed. It's not a shed. I mean, there's multiple units where we used to come here. It's like covered. There's eucalyptus everywhere. Like, it's very, it's totally magical, actually. Like, it's a magical place if you're a kid. It's like the memories are so vivid of coming here and getting to play on this furniture that was in front of the pot, which was in the back.
Does it feel like, this is not the kind of place you would expect anything to be going on here?
It does feel nestled and hidden and cozy, but that's Mill Valley. Like, everything in Mill Valley is nestled and cozy because it's a valley.
So you have fond memories of this storage shed is what you're saying.
Mega fond memories. I didn't get to go here very often, and I love it. Oh, yeah.
Did you wonder why? Or did you...
I know. I should have wondered why. I was so clueless. I didn't wonder why. I never got to do anything fun. I mean, no, I did. I got to do fun things all the time. But I was such a loud, annoying child. I didn't... Yeah. I was often told, you know, I didn't get to hang with the grown-ups.
Yeah, you were not a suspicious child, it doesn't seem.
I still am not a suspicious human. Like, I'm not a suspicious adult. Like, I am best friends with everybody. Like, nothing wrong is ever happening.
You were probably very, like, you know, they could just be like, hey, kid, go play in this furniture. And that was, like, perfect for them.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember if I smelled the pot, you know, because there were bales. Like, I'm, you know, maybe 1,000 pounds would be there or something. And you know what? It's interesting because it is in this grove of eucalyptus trees, and eucalyptus smell really strong.
Well, that's smart. That's something you should ask him. It's like, hey, did you take that into account?
Yeah, no, it's totally true because eucalyptus are an incredibly strong smell. And if you're unloading 1,000 pounds of pot, bales, it's a great idea to do it in a eucalyptus grove. I came here to the storage container area, the storage units, to sort of see what's going on. And that, I feel, is the takeaway. Is like, wow, this isn't a aromatic grove.
Yeah.
This storage unit represents sophistication and professionalism in my dad's industry. He has a permanent and reliable place to store the product. But before he acquired the storage unit, like what happens so much in the life of a smuggler, my dad loses all of his money and has to rebuild. This is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter. I'm Rainbow Valentine.
Rolling a doobie, young, free, and groovy, making it up as we roll along.
So it's 1974, and my dad has been with Taffy and her toddler in Northern California for 4 years. Organically, he's built a thriving cross-country pot smuggling business with a couple trusted friends in New York and his new West Coast contacts, the heavyweight smugglers of San Francisco's psychedelic revolution. My dad has been getting big deal after big deal. There's the lime green pot, dabbling in cocaine dealing, the first Panama Red trip, a minor hiccup getting arrested for bringing a nutcracker filled with a couple grams of pot to the airport. And then in 1974, it's the second Panama Red trip when the young stoned Brooklyn boys get busted in Indiana. Remember, that's my birthday. My literal birthday. Ah, yes, the state-of-the-art home video of my home birth. That dark and stormy night. My dad and mom are living in West Marin in the hippity-hobbity house with 5-year-old Vertica. And in a series of mistakes, my dad ends up losing all of our family's money. Broke, scared, and disillusioned, my parents move and try to start over in the straight world. When I say straight world, I mean the normal people world, not the psychedelic drug industry. My parents are scared of retaliation, and they're scared they might lose their kids. They dive into business as fashion designers and merchandisers.
After the day you were born and we lost all our money, I continue to be disillusioned. So I was very disillusioned, and I was too fearful to go back into the biz. And through other of our psychedelic friends, we were introduced to this very unusual aesthetic.
Having grown up in the 40s and 50s, my mom always made her own clothes. And the 1960s dance parties were all about dressing up in Victorian costumes found in San Francisco thrift stores. My mom was obsessed with fashion and costumes. So my parents are friends with this smuggler called the Millionaire. He's filthy rich from smuggling E.T., ergotamine tartrate, the base that you use to make LSD. And with his oodles of money, he wanted to start a clothing business.
We were introduced by my dentist. He wanted to make clothing. So Taffy and I and this other lady, he offered to give us the money to start a clothing company. And I said, hey, I don't know what I'm doing and blah, blah, and this and that, whatever. He said he didn't care. And we needed something to do because I had pulled out again, as usual. So we started the clothing company, and we named it after you, Rainbow Valentine. And we made very high fashion, modest clothes. And it was a really horrible time for me because I hated the clothing business. You had to be born into it just like any other. And I knew nothing about it, nor anybody in it really. So there I was doing all this stuff, and I didn't realize my job was to be the salesman.
My parents started their clothing line designing velour tracksuits, which 20 years later in 1996 put Juicy Couture on the map. But in the 1970s, no one was buying that.
Yeah, no, I'm not a great salesman. People say that to me. I am great at speaking about what I completely love. That's what I'm great about. And I'm not, you know, I was totally tentative in this. I didn't know what styles. The gig was just crazy, and it made me horrible. I couldn't do it. I was traveling to clothing shows, you know, in Dallas and New York and L.A. and Chicago, and it was horrible. I mean, the people I had to deal with were horrible people for me. The ladies were having a ton of fun. They just went off merrily designing whatever the fuck they wanted to make, you know. I'm forced to have to try and fucking sell it. I lost my completely lost my self-esteem from that one. And Taffy and I split up. I thought I was so worthless, and I failed, and I failed my family, and I've lost all this money for, you know. And I'm a sensitive guy.
After pouring everything into it, my parents' clothing business failed. They were out of luck, out of money, and the stress led my parents to separate. I barely remember this. I was probably 2 or 3. My dad is devastated. mom, me, and my sister move in with a couple of my mom's girlfriends. And my dad moves into a group house filled with the hippiest of hippies. So even today, after affirming he once traded acid for a VW bus of Redwood Burl slabs in Big Sur, my dad insists he's not a hippie. And his overwhelming memories of the time he and my mom separated are of being sad and lonely while living amongst irritatingly hippie hippies. But even in his cloud of depression, my dad finds his glass half full attitude.
I was really, really down and sort of disappeared for a minute into the hippie world, which was not me. But I put myself back together again, Humpty Dumpty that I was.
So my dad, a genuine Humpty Dumpty, endeavors to put himself back together again when three big things happened. First, he gets back into smuggling. In 1978, some of his New York pals hook him up with a trip involving a modest load of Colombian pot coming into Florida. My dad knows he's good at the smuggling business, and he needs to make a living, so he agrees to arrange a pickup for the product and distribution. He convinces this psychiatrist friend of my mom's to front him some money to hire a driver to score the pot in Florida. The driver knows people to sell it to in Chicago.
This other strange fellow I met, who I really didn't know very well and then never really hung out with after, said, "Oh, I got people in Chicago I can sell it to." And Chicago, I don't know, fucking Chicago, whatever.
So the driver and my dad head to Chicago to distribute and collect the profit.
And I don't remember the trip real well, other than that it wasn't particularly successful. I guess it was mediocre pot and whatever. We finally sold it, but I got the money. But that was my reinitiation back in 1978.
Well, the trip did end up being worth it. And now, digging themselves out of poverty, my parents are able to reunite, and we all move back in together into a rental house in the Mill Valley Redwoods. So the next thing that happened to put my Humpty Dumpty dad back together was an old friend came knocking with a thank you gift of $30,000. For a few years in the early 70s, my parents had helped out their friend, the broker, who was also a fellow smuggler. He was also a junkie, and my parents would let him stay at their house and take care of him when he was really doped up on heroin.
And I had been really good to him in the early 70s. When he was constantly fucked up and trying to kick junk, and we took care of him, and he crashed at our house at different points and blah, blah. And we had no idea that he was actually at the same time stealing our prescription drugs, which we didn't hardly used anyway.
Well, later, the broker makes a lot of money smuggling. He also spends some time in a Thai prison, but that's later. Anyway, he wants to make amends for taking advantage of my parents' hospitality and give them a thank you gift.
They were rolling in it, so he said, "Well, here, you know, for all that time you really took care of us, well, here's a bunch of money. Go buy a house in Mill Valley."
This money is the down payment on my childhood home. Finally, my family can stop moving and settle down. Now, the third and final thing that got my family back on its feet was in 1979, when opportunity knocked in the form of 60,000 pounds of Lebanese hash. You're listening to Disorganized Crime. I'm Rainbow Valentine. We'll be right back. My family truly gets back on its feet with this huge hash deal. My dad's New York friend and colleague, Blondie, was a big smuggler, part of the international operations. And he came into 60,000 pounds of Lebanese hash, and he needed everyone he knew to help him get rid of it. Blondie sends a couple of his guys to California to talk it over with my dad. Blondie knows my dad's been doing some smaller smuggles, like the Chicago one that was a couple hundred pounds of pot. But this was in the thousands.
The way I found out about it is all of a sudden, a whole two or three of the boys came and visited me, and they were just bubbling. We did it. We've brought in our first big trip. They were unquestionably the disorganized crime crew.
Okay. My dad agrees to the job. Finally, he's back in the big time business since he attempted to quit 5 years prior. He's ready to distribute 4,000 pounds of Blondie's 60,000 pounds of Lebanese hash.
So we're going to send out a truckload of 4,000 pounds for you. Okay.
Jeez, that's a lot. That's like how many elephants? Four elephants?
Well, no. 4,000 pounds? Yeah, that might be one elephant.
So our family loves elephants. In fact, the elephant is our family crest. So I decided to measure the pot in elephants. So an African male adult elephant averages 13,000 pounds. So Blondie sends out about a quarter of an elephant in Lebanese hash. Now, 4,000 pounds is also the average weight of a rhinoceros, by the way, or a fat giraffe, according to the internet. For those listeners out there unfamiliar with hash, it's a sticky, firm, resinous material, and you only need a pinch to get high. According to my everyday pot-smoking friends, it would take 1 to 3 years to finish smoking 1 pound of hash, since you only need a nib. So 4,000 pounds is a lot of product. Smuggling requires a lot of moving parts with different people in charge of different parts of the process. Now, there isn't a traditional chain of command, per se. It's more of a freelance kind of gig, but there is a chain of command in a freelance fashion. My dad would buy the product outright with a handshake deal and say, yeah, I'll take care of this 4,000 pounds of Lebanese hash. And him and Blondie handshake on it. And everyone's a freelancer. No one can bail you out. There's no 401ks. You're on your own. Everyone's an independent contractor. One of the most important jobs in smuggling is the driver, also known as the bagman. For this Lebanese hash deal, the driver was doubling his professional truck driving career with smuggling.
Well, okay, so the main trucker was this guy who was who drove big loads around. He was a professional truck driver. He had a Class A license. And this load came out in a huge horse trailer or a cattle trailer or some 40-foot huge thing.
Were there livestock in it and the hash?
No. There wasn't. There was, I can't remember. It's 40 years ago.
Over my dad's 22-plus year career, he worked with very few drivers. His main driver, who fastidiously hauled moving trucks of pot cross-country, is one of our oldest family friends, and we're going to call him Sandwich, because he once owned a tasty eatery that I loved as a child. When I called Mr. Sandwich to ask if he'd share his stories with me, he unleashed a torrent of riveting tales that he had never spoken aloud ever to anyone. His children still don't even know about his former smuggling career. Sandwich is another scrupulous, brilliant, nice Jewish kid from the East Coast. And my dad relied on him to rent moving trucks, buy out the Marin thrift stores of furniture, because, again, my dad would often hide the product behind furniture, and then drive and deliver the product to New York.
He'd rent the truck, and then from there he'd go buy out the St. Vincent de Paul, buy out a truckload of furniture, of used furniture, then bring it back to the warehouse. We'd pack it up.
Side note on the St. Vincent de Paul thrift store. It is absurd to learn that even Marin thrift stores are significant, because being a thrift store loving family, I often run into my family members at Marin thrift stores.
I have no idea what he did with the furniture loads, the truck loads. I really have no idea. I never asked him.
Okay, these sounds are my dad putting on his raincoat in the middle of our interview.
What I was into was solutions and success. I didn't care how it happened. That was not my part of the trip. That was Sandwich's part of the trip. Those details. Each of us did different parts. That way, we couldn't rat on each other almost.
Together, my dad and Sandwich would load thousands of pounds of pot into the back of a moving truck and the front with furniture. And Sandwich would take a few days to drive the load to my dad's guy in New York City. Annoyingly, the drives were almost always in the dead of winter, because that's when pot, harvested in the fall, is ready for delivery. What happened on Sandwich's cross-country drives was his business. My dad relied on him to successfully achieve his task totally, and my dad didn't concern himself with how it happened or what may have happened along the way. So Mr. Sandwich changed his mind about speaking to me on tape, but he gave me the thumbs up to share his stories. So Sandwich is driving a rented moving truck with a load of 4,000 pounds of pot from Mill Valley to New York. It's a snowstorm in January in Nebraska when the truck breaks down. Luckily at a truck stop, not the middle of the interstate. So Sandwich calls the truck company from a payphone. Of course, there are no cell phones in the 1980s. And the truck company sends out a new truck and thoughtfully a couple guys to help Sandwich unload and reload the truck's cargo. Now, my dad always hired a pilot and someone to ride shotgun, precisely in case this kind of situation arose. Well, Sandwich remembers convincing the truck rental guys their brawn was unnecessary and remarkably managed, along with his co-pilot, to unpack the broken truck and repack the new truck in a Nebraska truck stop in a snowstorm undetected. The snowstorm may have saved their skin, as frigid Midwest blizzards are less than ideal conditions for nosy Nellies or helpful cops looking to assist out-of-towners moving heavy furniture and or bales of pot. Sandwich's other driving close call happened in Wyoming. He, his co-pilot, and their moving truck of several thousands of pounds of pot, plus furniture, stop at a gas station, fuel up, and each thinking the other has paid the bill, continue on their way. Remember, this is the 80s, before you prepaid for gas. So they tootle on down the Wyoming interstate when Sandwich hears police sirens, and out his side mirror he sees a cop car indicating to pull over. Keep cool and don't arouse suspicion is smuggling 101. Sandwich pulls over, and the cop approaches the driver's side window. Did you guys just buy some gas? Sandwich and his co-pilot nod. Ah, did you pay for it? The cop asks. Sure, he did. Sandwich points to his co-pilot, who points to him simultaneously and says, I thought you paid. Both thought the other had paid for the gas, and in fact, no one had paid. Incredibly, they didn't suspect Sandwich of being anything other than forgetful. And then, instead of searching the truck and finding the pot, they escorted them back to the gas station. Sandwich has been integral to my dad's smuggling career. And along with finding great drivers, part of my dad's job was also to find places to put the pot. During the Lebanese hash trip in the late 70s, my dad had not yet gotten his storage unit that I loved going to as a kid. So each new smuggle required finding new places to put the product.
To set this up, I had to find a cool, quiet landing spot that was in the countryside. And so I reached out to one of my pals who lived in Sonoma. He turned me on to a friend who was actually a musician at the same time, and had a sort of a ranch that he lived out somewhere in, I don't know if it was Healdsburg or somewhere out there, and he had a ranch. So we brought the truck into this ranch in the middle of nowhere, basically, which was great, and we unloaded the whole thing in his barn.
A good location to store pot, according to common sense and my dad, is off the beaten path. Duh. My childhood house was incredibly private and off the beaten path. But my dad rarely stored large quantities of pot at my childhood house. That practice mostly went away along with his life savings on the night of my birth. Our Mill Valley home was important, though, for business. My dad liked privacy and, of course, needed a place for all the business vehicles. Plus, our house usually contained hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. Now, Marin and Sonoma counties are full of rambling country backroads dotted with old farmhouses, orchards with storage containers, and barns. These are good locations for storing pot for local delivery. Now, it's also a bonus if the storage location is fragrant to mask the aromatic merchandise. The Sonoma County farm town of Petaluma was a favorite pot storage location for local delivery. Now, anyone who's from Petaluma can tell you it regularly smells like cow shit at various times of the day. Storing pot for cross-country travel, however, is a different story. The storage location should be near the freeway for easy access. Move the truck in, move it out, and onto the freeway. My dad's storage unit in Mill Valley was right off the freeway and located in a massive grove of fragrant eucalyptus trees. Now, it took my dad 6 months to get rid of the Lebanese hash because apparently it wasn't high quality. And in the course of the 6 months, he had to move the stash to several different locations, all in the world-class honeymoon destination of wine country. And moving thousands of pounds of product is a pain in the ass because each new location requires new precautions. In one spot, he had to build a fake wall.
What I did specifically was I built a... The thing was so far, I don't know, 20 feet deep, whatever it was deep. And so I built a false wall about 15 feet. So with sheetrock and put the whole thing up. And we had a picture frame hanging on a nail. And that actually picture frame was, in fact, a cutout piece the picture frame was hanging right sideways like this on the wall on a piece of sheetrock. But when you took it off, the sheetrock and everything came off with the frame, you see.
Right.
So that you could get in behind
there. It was the secret entrance.
It was a secret stash, which was pretty cool. And it was relatively easy access, but it was San Rafael. It was a pain in the ass. And then we sold it to somebody else. It was passed down. I sold it for $10,000.
You own storage?
No, I didn't own it. I just had the lease, and nobody ever cared as long as a rent check was sent to the correct box. So I then sold it to these other guys.
So moving trucks packed with furniture and pot was my dad's method for smuggling pot cross country. Locally, he packed giant American cars like Buicks and Chevys with trunk loads of merchandise and drove slowly, something I've rarely seen, as my dad, a former New York City cab driver, usually still drives like one. We also had a big work truck with two gas tanks and a camper shell with curtains on the windows. I used that truck to move into my first San Francisco apartment in the late 90s and remember it breaking down right in front of the Robin Williams Memorial Rainbow Tunnel on the way over the Golden Gate Bridge. Our family work truck with double gas tanks now lives on a cheese farm in Petaluma. Each smuggler has his tricks and tips for smuggling in vehicles. The fancy white Chevy truck my dad bought for the Brooklyn Boys / busted birthnight trip was tricked out with a custom camping loft in the bed of the truck with secret compartments, which apparently were not so tricky to find. Other smuggler friends tricked out RVs with secret compartments and fried bacon on their smuggling drives to mask the pot aroma. Free Freddy, a smuggler from SoCal, perfected a method for stuffing tires with pot for his many Mexico-California trips. He also mentioned customizing the gas tank to hold drugs. Loads came into the San Francisco Bay on giant boats from South America or Asia. And then smugglers transported the loads to smaller fishing boats, which came into the Sausalito docks or local beaches. They were then moved to safe houses and then to people like my dad in work trucks or cars. Sometimes loads came in on helicopters. Free Freddy told me a story about bales of pot dropped in a California field from South American helicopters. Upon landing, the pot packaging broke, scattering buds everywhere. The smugglers gathered as much as they could find, but the farmer who owned the field called in a panic a few weeks later about the pot sprouting up all over his property. My mom has a story about a smuggler named Goldfinger, and oddly enough, his nickname foreshadowed his fate on one smuggling trip that involved a small plane.
This guy, Goldfinger, who looked like Goldfinger in the James Bond movie, and he was red-haired and he was called Goldfinger. Because he was pretty ruthless. And he was this huge smuggler. And he was going to meet this little smuggling plane on a runway somewhere in California. And he drove up with his Porsche and he jumped out before the plane stopped. And he ran towards it and he got his hand caught in the propeller and it cut it off at the wrist. And all his henchmen, you know, his assistants just went, oh my God. So he grabbed his hand and he made drive him to the hospital so they would sew it up back on, but they couldn't. I guess the hospital was too far away. And so that's the story of Goldfinger, that be careful what you name yourself. I didn't see it, but I heard he had a gold hand made that was a Coke spoon on the end of one of the fingers.
Are you kidding?
No!
Cannabis and cash were moved in suitcases, steamer trucks, and briefcases. I remember my dad's briefcase vividly. because it was always locked, making it rivetingly secret and grown-up-ish. Like I've mentioned before, one of the most enlightening things about producing this podcast is learning that almost everyone I grew up around had some involvement in the smuggling industry. Now, this is the mom of one of my BFFs who I've known for 40 years. And this moment you're about to hear is the first time I discovered that she, too, was a smuggler. She's also a photographer and has a PhD from two different Ivy Leagues.
Amanita is telling us her story of, as we shell peas, sharing and shelling.
The major way I have done personal smuggling of money, personal drug supplies, is wrapping the things up in yarn balls.
Yarn balls.
Yarn balls and knitting and crocheting as I'm going through customs.
Knitting and crocheting as you go through customs.
Well, yeah.
In the ball.
It's in the ball,
oh,
right.
That's great.
Right. Or when they would start examining my things, you know, I would probably pull out the yarn ball and start working on it. Yeah.
And what did you knit?
Scarves. Basic. One of my suitcases broke open as it came out of the luggage thing, and this yarn ball with $5,000 was rolling down. Yeah, it was funny.
Did the money become free of the yarn ball?
No.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, no. They were well-constructed yarn balls.
So, money stuffed in yarn balls. Brilliant. And if that doesn't work, or you don't have yarn, but you have a cat, smuggle with your pets in tow.
I was living in Ecuador. The good pot came from Colombia. I smuggled a couple of pounds of pot on a bus from Ecuador to Colombia in a pillow in a box with a cat on top of it.
Your cat?
Yes, my cat named Muda. She was a gray cat named Muda.
Wait, you put your pot in a pillow in a box.
I put my pot
in a box.
Wrapped up in a pillow, and then
hilarious.
That the cat was sitting on top of it.
Huh. That's great. You're the first person I've talked to who uses a cat to smuggle pot.
Yeah.
You have a theme as well. It's very cat yarn themed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize I was following in my dad's footsteps. I did smuggle pot a few times myself. I was a sophomore in college, studying abroad in the pot-legal Netherlands. Mindful my stoner friends back home were deficient in spectacular Dutch drugs, I crafted a care package of pot hidden in European candy bars. Lion bars have four wafers with light nougat between and a chocolate coating. I carefully removed the two middle wafers, leaving a structural floor and roof wafer, and I filled the middle with well-wrapped Amsterdam pot. I then resealed the candy bars with Nutella, re-glued the wrapper, and mailed them to the States. It was a gift within a gift, two imported treats. Everyone was thrilled when the Lion bars arrived in Boston. Smuggling pot and candy bars. It was a labor of love. Definitely not a sustainable business model. If I'd been interested in anything other than gift-giving and sharing the wealth. This is Disorganized Crime. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and we'll be right back. My dad likes to quote his lawyer, the late, great Bernie Siegel, who in the early 90s lamented, "The quality of the criminal has gone down." I never understood the quote until I started unfolding this story. My dad and his colleagues did business based on integrity, trust, and ethics. They were criminals, and that what they were doing was illegal, but they were trustworthy, honest, and reliable. Unlike the criminals emerging in the late 80s, early 90s that Bernie bemoaned. My dad and his friends did business based on a handshake.
So when you have 4,000 pounds of this hash, are you selling it like 10 pounds a pop?
Well, I'm not selling one at a time.
No.
And basically, you give it out to people who you trust. You give them 50 pounds here. You know, come back with the money whenever you get it done. You know, it's just, I mean, it's same as what they were doing to me was giving it out to all their friends. I was giving it out to all my friends.
So no money is passed hands. It's just this trust circle.
I mean, I wasn't selling it for cash.
Yeah.
Because most nobody would put up cash for, anyway. But that was the whole way it worked forever, is that huge amounts would be moved to one's close friends, associates, if they were doing big amounts. And that's how much of how I work and happened, is I had my reputation, which was really, I guess, obviously stellar enough to give me hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of stuff at different points. I don't even remember, you know, but that was the way we worked, and it was passed down.
But amongst this integrity and noble deeds was plenty of disorganization. The Lebanese hash deal ended up being the one where my dad lost the money in the backyard that we talked about in episode one, the BlackBerry story.
It was pretty stressful. That I couldn't fucking find at least $500,000 in cash.
Oh my God.
For my pals.
But my dad only lost the money in the yard because his smuggling colleagues trusted that he would hold on to the money for him. This Lebanese hash deal was so important. It got my dad back into big-time smuggling and provided much-needed income for our family after several years of poverty. And with this trip, my dad is really becoming a professional. He's back on his feet. And to solidify his professionalism after the Lebanese hash deal, that's when my dad treats himself to the right-off-the-highway storage unit, just a few miles from our Mill Valley home.
So I had this, that was funny, the revelation about the eucalyptus, and then remembering how much I loved to go to that storage unit, but I don't think I was allowed, I don't think you'd
no.
be there very often.
Are you kidding? You weren't, do you think, well, you think I wanted some noisy kid around there? What are you fucking kidding me? Jesus Christ. You were the worst. You would say, hey, come on over here, people. I mean, you wouldn't. I mean, you didn't. But you're an attractor.
So, by the end of the 70s, my dad, who came into an Insta family at the dawn of the decade, has made and lost the equivalent to hundreds of thousands of dollars smuggling pot. He's quit the pot industry, started and failed a non-drug related business, theoretically traded over $100,000 for a baby, me, lost his family, and restarted his smuggling business in a much more professional, serious, and covert way, making back hundreds of thousands of dollars and regaining his family.
God loves pot dealers.
Why did you tell her that? We've revealed our secret.
What, that,
that
you...
God is watching over us.
The pot dealers.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know...
I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter. Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter is written and recorded by me, Rainbow Valentine. Our producers are Gabby Watts and Taylor Church. Executive producers are Brandon Barr, Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, and me at School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Charles Bryant at iHeartRadio. Our music is by Gabby Lala and Claire Campbell, with original theme by Mark Caron and me. You can follow us online at disorganizedcrimepodcast.com.
Writing our own story, do it as we please. Tamil pious, sleeping princess of the redwood trees. She helps us keep it real. A handshake seals the deal. Grab the stash. Seal a meal and load up these old ways. Rolling a doobie, young, rich, and groovy. Making it up as we roll along. Rolling along, far out country road.